Welcome to Bladder Buzz, Beyond the Bladder, the podcast where doctors, researchers, and consumers discuss bladder health and function for those with neurogenic bladder. On today's episode, we welcome Dr. Mandy Rounds and Mary Ellen Kelly to discuss what is a neurogenic bowel. And now, Beyond the Bladder.
Welcome back to Bladder Buzz. I'm your host, Dr. Mandy Rounds, a research scientist at MedStar National Rehabilitation Hospital and MedStar Health Research Institute. In my work, I have the privilege of collaborating with individuals who have faced challenging conditions such as spinal cord injury, multiple sclerosis, stroke, and spina bifida. Neurological injuries and diseases don't just influence or affect an individual's mobility, bladder, and daily activities. They can also significantly affect their bowel function, and that's the focal point of our conversation today. I'm pleased to have Dr. Mary Ellen Kelly joining me today, a urology nurse practitioner from Duke University who specializes in the management of neurogenic bladder and bowel. She also leads the Spina Bifida Association's Research Advisory Council Group on Fecal Continence, works on the National Spina Bifida Patient Registry, and is the chair of the Pediatric Urology Nurses and Specialists Society in the U.S. Thanks for joining me today, Mary Ellen.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start off. Can you just explain the differences between a neurogenic bowel and possibly a typical functioning bowel?
Sure. So neurogenic bowel can occur, as you mentioned, through many different mechanisms. So some of the most common are a spinal cord injury or being born with spina bifida, people with multiple sclerosis, et cetera. And basically, it's telling us that something has happened neurologically, so to the nerves that communicate from the brain to the bowel. So by having a quote unquote neurogenic bowel, basically that communication is disrupted. So not only does that affect the way that you kind of sense the urge to use the restroom or that you are using the restroom, but it also causes a defect in the way that the muscles can communicate to the brain. So the muscles in somebody with neurogenic bowel might not work as well. And that could be the anal sphincter, so kind of the exit door. So that way it either is too tight or it is too loose. You can also have issues with the colon, the large intestine itself, where it's just not contracting as it should. So when I explain this to a lot of my pediatric patients, I will actually take out a tube of toothpaste and I poke fun at my husband or my brother or all the men it seems like I have lived with in my life. But, you know, a typically functioning bowel is sort of like taking a nice new thing of toothpaste and you eat some food, and then you get a nice contraction in your colon starting at the sealed end of the toothpaste that slowly moves nicely all the way to the end until you have a poop. But if you have neurogenic bowel, basically something is off in that system or multiple things are off. So somebody might grab the toothpaste in the middle and then somebody grabs it close to the exit and then it gets grabbed back at the sealed end. So you're getting contractions that aren't uniform. They're kind of grabbed anywhere along that toothpaste roll. And the cap to the toothpaste might just be open at all times. So if someone just grabs it in the middle, you might poop even though you didn't think you were going to. So it's really just causes a dysfunction in so many aspects of the bowel, whereas somebody else hopefully has a good awareness of when they need to use the restroom and they can voluntarily kind of say, ooh, this is not a good time. I need to wait a few minutes and then get to the restroom and voluntarily relax their anal sphincter and have a bowel movement where they would like.
That is a great example. So I probably am totally going to use that from now on. So thank you for that example. So let's talk a little bit about signs and symptoms of neurogenic bowel, since you gave a great example of kind of the physiology and how the muscles work and everything. So when should someone start implementing a bowel management strategy? Or are there specific indicators or milestones that sometimes suggest it's time to begin a bowel management program?
Sure. So the most common symptoms of neurogenic bowel dysfunction are either or. You can either be constipated or have issues with fecal incontinence, such as poop accidents, or you can have both constipation and fecal incontinence. That's usually like the first kind of bowel symptoms we talk about. And then you have all like your secondary issues, right? So people are more likely to have urinary tract infections or increased urinary incontinence. You can also have issues with anal fissures, so like cuts on your butt. You can have hemorrhoids, skin breakdown, especially if you're having a lot of incontinence, you can get more rashes on your butt, pressure sores. If you have a shunt for your brain, it's called a VP shunt. A lot of individuals with spina bifida will have this, that if you are really constipated, it can actually cause temporary shunt malfunction, which is a, you know, a major issue. So there's a lot of secondary effects as well. And then obviously quality of life concerns, which I know we'll talk about later. So what we're really trying to stress in the world of bowel research and everything else is that we really need to be implementing a bowel program as soon as somebody is injured, if that's the mechanism to a neurogenic bowel, or as soon as someone is born, if they have spina bifida or a birth defect. We have been waiting way too long, and that is our fault as clinicians, I think, in many ways, where we've been waiting until someone is, you know, in school or a teenager or going off to college. We are waiting way too late to then try to go in and get on a good bowel regimen. We really think this is something that needs to be talked about, like as soon as an injury happens again, or as soon as someone is born, or even before birth, if we know something's coming down the pipeline. My population I work with the most are spina bifida patients. And we know in that grouping, over 80% of individuals are going to need a bowel program. So if we know that fact outright, then I want to be talking to my patients in the NICU, like in the newborn phase, about your child's going to need something more than likely. Like, let's get that conversation started, just like we talk about urinary catheters or other things.
Yeah. So when you do start to get that conversation going, what are some of the common strategies, primary goals, methods for bowel management for these individuals with bowel dysfunction?
Yeah. I mean, it depends a bit on age. So, you know, really little babies and such, we talk about really just getting in a program in the sense of making sure they're not getting constipated. So we're really just working on keeping the consistency of the stool soft. And that can be as simple as, you know, what they're eating, what formula they're on, breastfeeding, some of those types of things. After that, it's really going to change based on the individual. So we're trying to shift, I think, the focus across the country and beyond, that we want to try to optimize bowel continence for individuals by the time somebody is in school. So, you know, if you're talking about kids, kids, we think about toilet training of the typical child being what, age 2 to 3-ish, maybe age 5, on the kind of slower end of things. And we think that we should line that up with kids with neurogenic bowel as well. So if somebody of a similar age is sitting on the toilet and trying to poop, well, so should these kids. And they might not be as quote unquote successful in a typical toilet training way, but we can work with them to get on a bowel program. So they are still sitting and trying to pass some stool with the aid of either enemas or suppositories or oral meds or some of these larger volume enemas, but on something. So that way they are toilet training at the same milestones as other kids their age and are continent by the time they start school. And in adults, we just need to get going as soon as we know about it, because we wait too long and then the bowel's usually stretched out so much that it just takes a lot longer to get people on a really good program.
That's great. I love the idea of training them, you know, when their peers are learning as well, yeah. Because that, I mean, that's huge when it comes to the stigma and everything. So what are some of the challenges that individuals may face when they're trying to come up with this bowel, you know, bowel strategies, when they're trying mm-hmm. to manage their bowel function, and how can they possibly be addressed?
Okay, so that's a big one. And there's so many challenges. And as you mentioned in your question, every individual is going to have a different set of challenges. Some of the most common ones I think I hear in clinic are time. So finding the time to do a bowel program. Some of these really take, you know, half an hour, hour. I've had patients say they sit on the toilet for 3 hours, which I think is far too long. But Nevertheless, these programs are not just in and out 30 minutes and you're done for most individuals. So finding the time, getting in that schedule. A huge one we see for all ages too is having somebody else to support. So not just like moral support, but physically helping with the bowel program. So like a caregiver or a parent who is assisting with the program. So a lot of individuals, depending on their stability or dexterity, will have trouble actually getting their bowel regimen set up or instilled into their body, even if it's like sitting on the toilet and reaching their butt. Like, that's not always the easiest thing, depending on what else is going on. So you need somebody else to help you. So finding those individuals, training those individuals, and ideally having more than one of those individuals. Again, a lot of my references are in peds with children, because that's my primary patient kind of population. But we hear from parents all the time, like, I haven't been able to go on vacation in, you know, X number of years, as long as their child has been alive, because nobody else knows how to do their bowel program. I can't even go out, you know, with my friends for a night, because that means my child won't have a bowel program. And I know that, you know, that means tomorrow they're going to have an accident while they're in school. So there is a lot of pressure on caregivers as well. And I think that caregiver burden is really big. So addressing that early and trying to, you know, get multiple people involved can really help diminish that.
Yeah. And I mean, on top of it, a lot of times they're doing a bladder program as well. And so mm-hmm. I hear the same thing of, you know, there's bladder, there's bowel, there's skin. So it's just so many things. So you're right, of addressing the caregiver aspect, you know, making sure there's multiple people or making them more independent the older that they get.
Oh, yeah.
Which I think is huge as well. Yeah. So thanks for addressing that. Is there any possible like misconceptions or stigmas associated with bowel that you have to address pretty early on when it comes to your patients?
Yeah. I mean, so I technically am a urology provider, but, you know, bladder and bowel are basically best friends. So they just come together, whether we want them to or not. And it is amazing to hear the differences between people who have urinary accidents versus bowel accidents, because I think the stigma with a bowel accident is just so much bigger than a bladder accident. And part of that's kind of the obvious, right? Like, stool is just not something anybody really loves to talk about. It's generally stinky. Like, it's messier to clean up. Like, there's nothing beautiful about bowels. And I think people are more embarrassed when they have neurogenic bowel incontinent episodes. And, you know, that's not just coming from what I hear from patients, but we've got research studies that kind of show that too. And we know, individuals who have bowel incontinence, no matter how infrequently they have it, it really affects their quality of life. It impacts their ability to attain employment. If they have bowel incontinence, they're more likely to be unemployed or underemployed, so not at their full potential. And they have increased school absences. There's just a lot of long-term effects, I think, from that stigma of having bowel incontinence. So we really need to do a better job of getting people on programs early.
Yeah, I completely agree. Whenever there's a bowel accident during our research projects, or, you know, when they're inpatient, that you can tell affects them so much more than a bladder accident. So let's talk a little bit more about healthcare professionals, doctors, nurses, and everyone that kind of assists in maintaining these effective bowel managements. Is there specific ways that they can help assist? But also, is there any way that the individual can communicate to healthcare providers their needs and challenges a little bit more effectively or more helpful for the healthcare provider to hear as well?
Yeah, I think constant communication is really the big one. I know within our practice, we're really working on that as well. And that can be difficult based on kind of how the physician's practice is sort of set up, right? So are you able to talk easily to your doctor, your nurse practitioner, or do you have to go through, you know, an administration staff? Do you have electronic medical record where you can send, you know, a little inbox message or whatnot? So some of that is going to be based on kind of your hospital's practice or your clinic's practice. But in general, if you can find somebody who really does care about neurogenic bowel and is knowledgeable on it, then we talk about really talking with them frequently. So if you are just starting a program or have just made a pretty significant change to your program, then like in our protocol, we kind of recommend every 2 weeks you should be checking in. And keeping a bowel diary is huge. Keep a bowel diary at home. Like, when did I do my bowel program? What exactly was in it? What was it kind of consisting of? When did I have an accident? How long was I sitting on the toilet? Any of that information really helps to show a pattern. And then whoever's helping to interpret it or change your program has that to base off of. So the biggest communication pieces are keeping a bowel diary and really keeping close tabs with somebody who's managing the program when you're making a change or having an issue. And again, we think that's like an every 2 week, you know, basis. You don't want you people out there for months and months just waiting for their next scheduled clinic appointment to come back.
That's great. So I always think it's best to end on like a success story or, you know, a real life story. Could you give a success story or an example of a time that an individual did significantly improve their quality of life through proper bowel management?
I feel like there's so many, which is great.
That is great. Yay. So yes. Pick your favorite.
Okay. Oh, goodness. Okay. I mean, again, I'm in peds, so I have a lot of really cute kid stories about it. But we've had kids who, you know, kind of come in and they're all, you know, missing school a lot because they're having incontinence. We've had a few that have actually dropped out of formal school and kind of gone into like a homeschool program or something, so they didn't have to be around their peers because they were getting bullied, et cetera, with bowel incontinence. So I have one patient who was kind of in that situation. They were a middle schooler and were getting significantly bullied. So the parents decided it just wasn't worth it, pulled them out of school, getting homeschooled. We were homeschooled, so we actually had a lot of time. We talked a lot. We got on a really good bowel regimen. And it took, you know, the rest of that school year, but by the next school year, they enrolled him in another school. We didn't go back to the same one. We went to a new school. But the kid was psyched. They were able to actually wear underwear to school for the first time. They were no longer in pull-ups. They were like, just, it was like a whole new start to their life again. And middle school is not exactly an easy phase for anybody. So I think giving them that confidence to really like grow their self-esteem during that kind of phase of life is going to be lifelong, you know, going to be a lifelong change for that kid. And there's so many stories like that. It's just so exciting.
That's so great. Thank you for sharing that. I guess that's it for this podcast. So listeners, we will make another podcast that goes a little bit more into details about a stepwise approach to bowel management. Otherwise, thank you for joining.
Thanks so much. This is great.
Bladder Buzz is presented by the Rehabilitation Research and Training Center on Neurogenic Lower Urinary Tract Dysfunction. The information presented in this podcast does not express the views of the individual's employer or affiliated institutions. The content is for informational and reference purposes only and should not be used as a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment, or as the sole source of guidance for decision-making. We advise you to always consult with a physician before making any healthcare decisions or for guidance about a specific medical condition. Thanks for listening. Come back soon.